Chapter 4. Early Female Narrators. A history of a 6 weeks tour through a part of France, Switzerland, and Holland, and Matilda, 1817 to 1821. Anonymity. There was no trumpet call, no flurry of announcements in the press when Mary Shelley made her literary debut. Having returned to England in the autumn of 1816, she and Percy continued to be reviled by the English press and excluded from London society despite the fact that they were now married. Claire, who gave birth to Byron's baby in the spring of 1817, lived with them, and many believed that Percy was the father of the little girl, Allegra. The Godwins accepted Mary Shelley's relationship with Percy now that they were wed, but most people still regarded them with suspicion, as dangerous radicals and rule-breakers. In the midst of such a hostile environment, it made sense for Mary Shelley to avoid yet more criticism by starting her career anonymously. But this meant her entrance into the literary world was silent as the tomb. She published 2 books within 3 months of each other. A History of a 6 weeks Tour Through a Part of France, Switzerland, and Holland in November 1817, and Frankenstein in January 1818. Although the secrecy protected her from slander, particularly from those who criticized her for running away with Percy, the result was that, like her fictional counterpart, Margaret Walton Saville, Mary Shelley's role as editor and author was almost invisible to the public. The fate of her 3rd book, Matilda, which she wrote 2 years after Frankenstein, was even more dispiriting. She wrote it while abroad in Italy and sent it to her father for his editorial advice, but he stopped its publication entirely, deeming it too scandalous for public consumption. 6 weeks, 1817. Although Mary Shelley's first published work, A History of a 6 weeks Tour Through a Part of France, Switzerland, and Holland, 6 weeks, is less well known than Frankenstein, it is a fascinating counterpoint to the famous novel. Ostensibly a joint creation with Percy, in actuality, Mary Shelley wrote most of the material and oversaw the book's organization. Percy contributed the preface, the poem, Mont Blanc, and a few observations in the 1st and 2nd sections based on letters and the shared journal that they kept during their trip to Europe in 1814, but she was responsible for everything else, including the 2nd section of 4 letters from 1816, 2 of which she had written to Fanny when they lived in Geneva. The 3rd and 4th were a compilation of her journal entries and 1 of Percy's letters. She placed Mont Blanc at the end of the book, representing the book's creative apex. In 6 weeks, instead of being an offstage presence like Margaret Walton Saville, she positions herself as an active commentator, editor, and speaker, filling the pages with her first-person reflections, opinions, and insights. Towns are disgusting or divine. On their 1st trip to Europe in 1814, she and her unnamed companions, Percy and Claire, make what she calls the eccentric decision to walk across France for the sheer romance of it. They buy an ass for her to ride, as I was too weak to walk as far as the others. But Percy sprains his ankle and has to ride the donkey, leaving the 2 women to struggle along behind, laden with their cases and supplies. She records their meals, stinking bacon, sour bread, and where they slept, in barns, on straw, or upright in chairs to avoid the fleas, along with careful descriptions of the countryside. But she wanted 6 weeks to be more than a travelogue. Modeling the book on Wollstonecraft's Letters from Sweden, she includes her ideas about art, local customs, and geography, as well as her own thoughts and emotions. She has feelings of exquisite delight on the shores of Lake Lucerne, but is repulsed by other travelers on their barge trip down the Rhine. She also expresses her radical political views with ringing clarity. All those of every nation in Europe who have a fellow feeling with the oppressed cherish an unconquerable hope that the cause of liberty must at length prevail. As the scholar Paul Stock observes, Mary's use of the word liberty signals to her readers that she is committed to political reform. True lovers of freedom, she declares, will unite and overturn the detested dynasties of monarchical governments. She also summons the ideal of the sentimental community, a term that the critic Margaret Cohen argues was first used by 18th-century writers Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Germain de Staël, and others. This idea, which she would develop in her later fiction, was based on the principle of sympathy for the oppressed and an emotional connection amongst reformers that would transcend differences of nationality, class, race, and gender, leading to the successful resistance to tyranny. She articulates her stance against war, calling it a plague, and describes France after the Napoleonic Wars as a country pillaged and wasted. She makes a special point of recording the distress of the inhabitants, whose houses had been burned, their cattle killed, and their wealth destroyed, observations that she would later develop in her historical novels Valperga and The Fortunes of Perkin Warbeck. While Mary Shelley was recording her political observations, leaders from Britain and Europe were meeting in the Congress of Vienna in an attempt to prevent the rise of another leader like Napoleon. Although Mary Shelley, like other liberals, was inspired by and supported the international attempt to preserve peace, she joined with others in hoping the Congress would push forward reforms based on human rights. But she was to be disappointed. Although the Congress reestablished the boundaries of European states and forged new treaties, creating a 40-year peace that did not end until the First World War, the reforms that she and others hoped for never came to pass. Indeed, the monarchical system was preserved throughout Europe, and the oppression of working people continued unabated, infuriating reformers such as Percy and Mary Shelley. On their return to Europe in 1816, she focuses less on politics and more on the sublimity of the landscape, describing the enormous impact of witnessing Mont Blanc for the first time. "I never knew, I never imagined what mountains were before. The immensity of these serial summits excited, when they suddenly burst upon the sight, a sentiment of ecstatic wonder, not unallied to madness." Influenced as she was by the romantic sublime in Coleridge and the writing of her own parents, she views the landscape as important for the psychological impact it has on the onlooker. In this case, her encounter with Mont Blanc becomes a transcendent moment, lifting her out of the mundane world into the world of wonder. Although these passages are the basis for her descriptions of the landscapes in Frankenstein, there is little else to suggest that the same author has written both books. Indeed, the style and themes of the two volumes seem so different that the contemporary reading public can be forgiven for not recognizing the same hand in both. For Mary Shelley, though, the two books were closely linked. Based on letters and journal entries from their time in Geneva, the second section of 6 weeks was written at the same time that she began Frankenstein. In fact, the idea for the book had been percolating the whole time she was working on her famous novel. Accordingly, it did not take her long to ready the manuscript for 6 weeks for publication. After she finished Frankenstein, she began to edit the letters and diary entries that would form the basis of 6 weeks. Having decided not to write new material, she confined herself to condensing and extending the writing she had done while abroad. She and Percy were living in the English countryside during this period, and although she was in the final trimester of her third pregnancy and had just finished more than a year of sustained effort on Frankenstein, she worked on the new book with energy and characteristic self-discipline, putting the last touches to the manuscript after she gave birth to Clara on 2 September 1817. In 6 weeks, Mary Shelley explores all that she had left out of her novel, describing what it was like to be a young Englishwoman in Europe, with romantic sensibilities, liberal politics, and an active curiosity. Indeed, 6 weeks can be read as the inverse of Frankenstein, revealing the world as seen through the eyes of a young woman, the very perspective that is lacking in the novel. The letters she includes are the letters she wrote to Fanny, giving them an added poignancy, as they serve a kind of memorial to her dead half-sister. She records the halcyon days in Switzerland with Percy, exactly the sorts of days that Victor never gets to enjoy with his bride, Elizabeth. Our time passes swiftly and delightfully. We read Latin and Italian during the heats of noon, and when the sun declines, we walk in the garden of the hotel, looking at the rabbits, relieving fallen cockchafers, and watching the motions of a myriad of lizards who inhabit a southern wall of the garden. In my present temper of mind, the budding flowers, the fresh grass of spring, and the happy creatures about me that live and enjoy these pleasures are quite enough to afford me exquisite delight, even though clouds should shut out Mont Blanc from my sight. What she does not say was that these were the pleasures that Fanny had never had the opportunity to experience. The world had been a hostile place for a young woman like her half-sister, born out of wedlock, unwanted, and a perpetual reminder of her parents' illicit relationship. 6 weeks was positively reviewed, but did not sell well. The young couple, who were perennially short of money, turned their hopes to Frankenstein. But in one of the great ironies of literary history, Frankenstein would earn few royalties for its author. When Frankenstein was published, reviewers called it horrible and disgusting. The Monthly Review disparaged it as uncouth and utterly amoral. And yet, the novel's shocking story did catch people's attention, and there was much speculation about the identity of the author. Most people assumed it was Percy, not only because of the scandalous narrative and the violent scenes, but because he had written the preface to the book, and the dedication was to his father-in-law. No one suspected Mary Shelley, as it seemed impossible that a woman could write such a monstrous tale. Leaving England. After the financial failure of Frankenstein, Mary Shelley and Percy turned their hopes for income to the long poem, The Revolt of Islam, which Percy had written that summer. But Islam had even fewer sales than Frankenstein. Critics largely ignored the poem, and the few grudging reviews that did appear attacked Percy personally, calling him an atheist, scolding him for his vile political views, and blaming him for Harriet's suicide. Discouraged by the hostile reception of their work, the couple began to make plans to leave England. They had not been abroad since their summer in Geneva, and they missed the experience of living far from England, in a community with other like-minded artists. In 1817, Percy had gone to court to try to win custody of the two children he had with Harriet, but had been dealt a severe blow, as the court took the unusual step of ruling against him, assigning the guardianship of 3-year-old Ianthe and 2-year-old Charles to Harriet's parents. In the 19th century, a father's rights were rarely questioned in such cases, but perceptions about Percy's immorality had cost him dearly. Mary Shelley worried that the negative articles in the paper could provoke more legal proceedings, as the prosecution had also threatened to take William and Clara away during Percy's battle for custody. Even worse, she was concerned that if people found out who really wrote Frankenstein, they might declare her an unfit mother. In the spring of 1818, almost 2 years after their sojourn in Switzerland, and just a few months after the publication of Frankenstein, they decided to follow the lead of Byron, who had gone to live in Italy. They packed up their belongings and set forth in March, taking Claire and Allegra with them. Mary Shelley was filled with excitement. Percy was suffering from a variety of physical ailments, and she always worried about the health of her children. Surely the sunny climate of Italy would improve her family's well-being. She also liked the idea of leaving behind all of the prejudices of English society. It was these judgments and restrictive social mores that had brought Fanny and Harriet to take their own lives, she believed. Italy offered her the opportunity to live more freely and to gain distance from the ghosts of both young women who still haunted her dreams. Italy. When they arrived in Italy on 30 March 1818, Mary Shelley's joy spilled over into her journals and letters. Everywhere she looked, she saw beauty. On 6 April, she wrote, "The fruit trees all in blossom, and the fields green with growing corn." She and Percy had read Homer to prepare for their trip and were eager to see the land of classical antiquity. "In Italy," she exclaimed, "we breathe different air, and everything is pleasant." The children's health improved, just as she had hoped, and Percy, too, felt stronger. One of their goals was to introduce Byron to his child, assuming that if Byron wanted custody of Allegra, he would allow Claire to remain in contact with her 15-month-old. But they had not reckoned with Byron's autocratic nature. He did not want to see Claire, he declared, and wrote demanding that Allegra be sent to him in Venice. Claire was broken-hearted at the prospect of parting with her toddler, but there was nothing she could do. Byron was the father, and as such, had all the power. All three wept when they bade farewell to the little girl. Mary Shelley tried to reassure Claire that Allegra would have a far more successful future if Byron acknowledged her as his daughter than if she remained the sole daughter of an unwed mother, with no money, no reputation, and no family. No one wanted her to share Fanny's fate. But it was with heavy hearts that they traveled southwest to Livorno and settled in the 3-story Villa Bertini, perched high in Bani di Luca, a fashionable resort, a day's ride from Livorno. It was an easy walk to town, and yet it was also private, as the house was surrounded by a tall, thick hedge. On 15 June, Mary wrote to her friend, Maria Gisborne, exulting in their good fortune. "When I came here," she declared, "I felt the silence as a return to something very delightful from which I had long been absent." Soon, they settled into a routine, reading, writing, and exploring the countryside. They had brought a nursemaid from England who helped Mary look after 2-year-old William, whom they called Wilmouse, a busy toddler, intent on exploring the world around him. 10-month-old Clara napped and smiled at her mother and aunt. Mary Shelley had never been happier. But tragedy was soon to strike. Late that summer, Byron agreed to let Claire visit her daughter. She left Bani di Luca in high spirits, but once she arrived in Venice, she wrote a frantic letter, demanding Percy come to help her deal with Byron's drunkenness and unstable moods. She was worried for Allegra's safety. Percy set forth at once, leaving Mary Shelley with the 2 children. She did not like Percy and Claire to spend too much time alone, but she did not think it wise to travel in the heat of the summer with 2 small children. Then, after Percy left, Clara developed a fever. She wrote to Percy that she feared for Clara's health, but Percy wrote back, reassuring her about Clara and asking her to come to Venice. To Mary Shelley, this response seemed heartless and appallingly selfish. Did he not care about the health of their little girl? The weather was oppressive, the journey long. Still, Claire's intimacy with Percy troubled her, and so, when Percy wrote again, begging her this time, she made the decision to go. For 3 days, she held the feverish Clara on her lap, willing the little girl to survive the long, bumpy trip. But despite her efforts, Clara's health steadily worsened. When at last they arrived, the toddler rallied for a short while, but her fever rose sharply, and a few weeks later, she died in Mary Shelley's arms. To Percy's horror, she refused to let go of the child's body, and he had to tear the little girl from her arms. He buried Clara on the Lido, while Mary Shelley mourned in her room, recording her child's death in the same notebook where she had marked the deaths of Fanny and Harriet, writing, "This is the journal book of misfortunes." Having lost another child, she feared that she herself was the problem. She had been the cause of her mother's death. She had lost her first daughter, and now Clara. In her despair, Fanny's death, and Harriet's too, seemed to be her fault. Unable to forgive herself, she retreated into a stony, impervious silence, certain that she was being punished for the harm she had caused others. Maybe this was Harriet's revenge. Percy mourned her absence, but she refused to smile at him, blaming him as much as she blamed herself. If he had not begged her to come to Venice, Clara would still be alive. They had planned to go to Naples that winter, and Percy decided they should still go, as the landscape was lovely and the weather mild, but Mary Shelley remained lost in grief. In January, Wilmouse celebrated his third birthday. The little boy was lively and strong, but she still worried about his health. Not until the end of February, when they set forth for Rome with Claire, did she feel a lifting of her spirits. Delighted to be in the ancient city, she drew closer to Percy, exploring the nooks and crannies together. They went for long, rambling walks, with 3-year-old Wilmouse trotting along next to them, holding their hands, exclaiming, "Oh, di che bella," at the marvels his parents pointed out. Mary Shelley was proud of William's fluency in Italian and enjoyed seeing Rome through the eyes of a child. On 12 March, she described him for her friend Marianne Hunt. "Our little Will is delighted with the goats and the horses and the lady's white marble feet," giving us a glimpse of her 3-year-old, tall enough to enjoy the naked toes of the statues his parents admired. For both Percy and Mary Shelley, Wilmouse was even more precious after the death of Clara. Fortunately, his health was good, though both parents fussed over him, instituting a regime of cold baths to keep him strong. In April, Mary Shelley realized she was pregnant again. Filled with hope, she and Percy spent their mornings riding in the open air. Their life in this old city seemed charmed, almost as perfect as she had dreamed it might be. But in May, all of her pleasure vanished. Wilmouse fell ill, complaining of a stomach ache. The doctor diagnosed worms, but the little boy did not recover. Over the course of a week, he grew steadily sicker as she watched helplessly. In the first week of June, she recognized that he was going through the convulsions of death that Clara had endured 9 months earlier. On 5 June, she wrote to her friend, Maria Gisborne, "The hopes of my life are bound up in him." And at noon, on 7 June, William died. Mary Shelley's third child was gone. Figure 6, malaria, or Roman fever, was the final diagnosis. Percy wept, but Mary Shelley was inconsolable. On 29 June, she wrote to Marianne Hunt, "I ought to have died on the 7th of June." With Claire, they moved to the countryside north of Livorno. Wrung out with grief and exhausted from her pregnancy, Mary Shelley stopped writing in her journal. She could hardly bear to talk to Percy or Claire. If she were not pregnant, she might have considered suicide, writing to Marianne Hunt that she was not fit to live. Tortured by the sameness and the silence of the days, she finally picked up her pen in August, starting the new novel that her father would declare too shocking to be published in her lifetime. Fueled by desolation, she wrote quickly, finishing the story in 6 weeks. Matilda, 1819. She named the book after her heroine, Matilda. Like Frankenstein, this eponymous novel explores the consequences of male obsession and power. But this time, Mary Shelley places a female character center stage, allowing her fictional heroine to shape the narrative, as she herself had shaped the story, in 6 weeks. Even more importantly, Matilda is the only narrator. Mary Shelley does not allow anyone else to contest Matilda's version of events, a departure from 6 weeks, where she gave Percy room to provide his point of view on their journey, and from Frankenstein, with its layered narrative structure. Originally, she had conceived of the story as a continuation of one of her mother's unfinished works, The Cave of Fancy, a tale that resonated for the grief-stricken Mary Shelley, as it painted a desolate world filled with mourning and disappointment. But as she worked on her story, it grew darker than even her mother could have imagined. In Mary Shelley's tale, Matilda writes her life story for her friend, the poet Woodville, as she lies on her deathbed, having made the decision to kill herself through self-inflicted consumption. There are many parallels between Matilda and her author. Matilda, like Mary Shelley, is a writer. Like Mary Shelley, she lost her mother in childbirth. But these similarities do not mean that Mary Shelley intended the novella to be read as autobiographical. As Jenny D. Plachetti notes, Mary Shelley resisted such reductive readings of her fiction. For Mary Shelley, the importance of her work lay in its embodiment of her ideas, particularly her stance against male tyranny, and not as a record of her personal experiences. Right from the beginning, Matilda's story diverges from Mary Shelley's. For the first 16 years of her life, Matilda's father is absent. When he returns, she is at first delighted by their closeness, but when he grows increasingly gloomy, she worries about his dark moods and pushes him to reveal the source of his unhappiness. At length, he confesses that he harbors an incestuous love for her and rushes away. Matilda gives chase, like the creature chasing after his father in Frankenstein. But when at length she finds him, she discovered that he has killed himself. Filled with regret for pushing him to confess his feelings, she retreats from the world and determines that her life is no longer worth living. On her deathbed, she utters the words that Wollstonecraft told Godwin her own mother had spoken on her deathbed, "A little patience, and all will be over." A speech that Wollstonecraft had also given the dying mother of her heroine in her last novel, Maria. Mary Shelley italicized these words to underscore the novella's connection to Wollstonecraft. As Wollstonecraft had argued in The Rights of Woman, women had no legal or political recourse when victimized by men. Mary Shelley dramatizes her mother's point by demonstrating the havoc that Matilda's father wreaks in his daughter's life. Unchecked male power is not only unjust, she suggests, it's dangerous for all involved. When Matilda suffers at the hands of her father, she does not react with rage, nor does she seek revenge, like the creature in Frankenstein. Instead, she asserts her agency by criticizing her father's excesses and choosing to be unlike him. We never get to hear his version, since, unlike Frankenstein, there is no battle between the narrators. As the sole storyteller, Matilda controls the course of events. She confesses that in childhood, she dreamed of union with her absent father, but unlike her father, who is unable to control his feelings when he meets her again as a teenager, she is now horrified by these desires. By relegating them to the past, she demonstrates more maturity and self-control than her father, triumphing over his disturbing fantasies by asserting her truth, telling a survivor's tale. Although she decides to commit suicide like her father, Matilda's death is a slow, considered act, one of agency, not passion. As Michelle Faubert argues, Mary Shelley depicts Matilda's choice as virtuous, honorable, and even socially beneficial. Like other romantic authors, Mary Shelley used the theme of the noble suicide to explore questions of free will and individual agency. But in Mary Shelley's case, she also presented Matilda's suicide as a powerful critique of the patriarchal system in which she lived. By the end of her life, and the end of her story, Matilda's pain ebbs as a result of her decision to die. She no longer feels horror when she contemplates her father's suicide and declares that she has stopped brooding over his corpse, saying, "I will not continue to trace this frightful picture." As Angela Wright points out, rather than focusing on horror and passion, like Victor and Walton, Matilda turns the reader's attention to renewal and beauty, ending the novel with an image of regeneration. "The turf will soon be green on my grave, and the violets will bloom on it." Matilda's voice is not yet the voice of reason of Mary Shelley's future heroines, but it is the voice of female agency that, absent from Frankenstein, characterizes 6 weeks. Unlike Walton and Frankenstein, who emphasize the terrifying details of their tales and are clearly imprisoned by their passions. Wright argues that Matilda refuses to fall into the abyss of her father's dark story, separating herself from his corrupted narrative. Mary Shelley may have intended Matilda's suicide to be a sign of her strength and independence, but this does not make the novella's conclusion a happy one. Deeply wounded by her father, Matilda cannot go on to live a full life. That she must die to achieve freedom from her pain is a bitter condemnation of the society in which she lives. Her father's lust has effectively caused her to erase herself, a response that may be noble and even brave, but is still a tragedy. For, as Mary Shelley makes clear, what kind of choice is this, suffering or death? What kind of world leads a virtuous young woman to choose non-being instead of life? Mary Shelley reinforces the tragedy of her tale by emphasizing her heroine's talents and virtue, indicating that Matilda could have lived a life of great value if she had not been harmed by her father. She underlines Matilda's romantic delight in the natural world, giving Matilda a passionate connection to nature and a purity achieved through suffering and intense emotion. My greatest pleasure was the enjoyment of a serene sky amidst these verdant woods. Yet I love all the changes of nature, and rain and storm, and the beautiful clouds of heaven brought their delights with them. At the same time, she makes it clear that Matilda would never have wanted to die if it were not for her father. If pain can purify the heart, Matilda says, mine will be pure. Although Mary Shelley does not excuse Matilda's father, she does suggest that Matilda's father is himself a victim of the patriarchal system. If he had not been allowed to satisfy his every whim and had received a better education, he might have been better able to exercise his talents and lead a virtuous life. But as a wealthy white man, he has never experienced any checks on his desires or his power. Early on, he fed his imagination with sickly romances, learning to indulge his impulses, not restrain them. Even more troubling, as Deanna Koretsky points out, incest often suggests a disastrous wish for racial and ethnic homogeneity. By uniting with Matilda, he can keep the outside world at bay, preserving his own power and the purity of his own bloodline. In contrast, Mary Shelley presents Matilda's mother, Diana, as an ideal figure. Having been taught by her father, one of the few good fathers in Mary Shelley's fiction, to value education over impulse and reason over emotion, Diana lives a life of self-discipline and virtue. As a wife, she serves as a moderating influence, restraining her husband's volatility. But after her death, her husband cannot control his emotions, destroying himself and his daughter with his excesses. By painting this idealistic portrait of Diana, Mary Shelley emphasizes Matilda's loss when her mother dies. If Diana had lived, she would have been able to contain her husband and protect her daughter. In addition, she would have given Matilda an excellent education. But instead, Matilda is immediately vulnerable when Diana dies, making Mary Shelley's point clear. Without strong mothers and wives, the world is a dangerous place for daughters. To Mary Shelley, uncontrolled patriarchal power was clearly dangerous for everyone, including the patriarchs themselves. Women needed to be empowered to offer an alternative mode of being, one based on love, education, and cooperation, rather than on aggression and ambition. When Mary Shelley sent the manuscript to her father, he was appalled and refused to send it to a publisher. Although some scholars have suggested that Godwin thought the novella was too autobiographical, what seems more likely is that he was trying to keep the family away from further scandal, as the reputations of Mary Shelley, Percy, Byron, and Claire had already been tainted by rumors of incest during their sojourn in Geneva. Mary Shelley did not argue with her father, as she did not want another rupture with him. But this was a significant loss for her career, as the novel was short, easy to read, and could well have been popular, suited as it was to the era's taste for melodrama. But there is another reason that Godwin might have loathed Matilda. Mary Shelley's indictment of a bad father and of a world without mothers, in which women are prevented from occupying leadership roles, either inside the family or out, was also an implicit condemnation of Godwin himself. This was not a new theme. In Frankenstein, Victor is a terrible father, abandoning his creature. With neither father nor mother, the creature turns to violence. But in Matilda, Mary Shelley makes this point even more clearly. Matilda's father is the villain of the story, particularly in contrast to Diana's ideal father. The motherless Matilda seeks her own agency by resisting her father's predations and refusing to participate in his fevered longings. This theme of the bad father dominated Mary Shelley's work right from the beginning, even when it was concealed from the reader. 6 Weeks, for example, does not appear to be a narrative about fathers, as parents are never mentioned, but hidden beneath the narrative is the story of her flight from her autocratic father. In 1814, Mary Shelley, Percy, and Clare did not simply set forth for Europe to enjoy an adventure. They fled England to escape Godwin's attempt to separate the young lovers. In 1816, when Godwin still refused to accept his daughter's relationship with Percy, they journeyed to Geneva to escape his critical eye. The reader can be forgiven for missing this theme, as at no point does Mary Shelley mention that their adventures stemmed from their attempt to free themselves from patriarchal restrictions. Nor does she recount any of the drama of that first flight, the secret decision to run away, the tiptoeing down the stairs, the note she propped on the mantelpiece for Godwin to read after she was gone, the pre-dawn departure, the frantic carriage ride from London, the overnight crossing to France, their pursuit by Mary Shelley's stepmother, Mary Jane, who found them in Calais and tried to persuade Clare to return home. Nevertheless, though Mary Shelley leaves all this unsaid, the book is still a testimonial to rebellion, still a story about three young people's revolt against parents. The vivacity that Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine noted in the writing stems in part from the triumphant quality of the narrative. Indeed, each joyful moment in 6 Weeks, and even each distressing moment, becomes a symbol of the young people's hard-won freedom. They had wonderful adventures, Mary Shelley writes, and these adventures helped shape them into writers who were committed to liberal causes. Once they were released from parental tyranny, they poured themselves into their work, composing poems and novels for which they would one day become famous. When considered together, these three early works explore the options of abused children. They can liberate themselves, 6 Weeks, avenge themselves, Frankenstein, or separate themselves, Matilda. When the father is either oppressive or dangerous, the children need to escape paternal tyranny, as the three young people do in 6 Weeks, and Matilda does by separating herself from her father, envisioning a different world, free of horror, where flowers grow quietly in the grass, and new growth emerges from the grave. In Frankenstein, on the other hand, Victor's rejection of his son leads to disaster. By abandoning the creature, he abandons his duties as a parent, leaving his child to fend for himself in a world that treats him with cruelty. Ultimately, Mary Shelley makes it clear that Victor is to blame for the creature's violence. If Victor had been capable of parenting his son, she implies, the creature might never have given way to destructive rage. In all three works, Mary Shelley depicts education as an important tool, but it has to be the right education. Both Victor and Matilda's father receive little guidance when they are young. As a result, they never learn to check their impulses, and the results are catastrophic for their children, demonstrating the generational impact of education, for good or ill. In 6 Weeks, though, the opposite is true. The children break free, and once they have escaped, they are liberated to learn from their own experiences and their own travels. To Mary Shelley, too much restraint is harmful. but so also is too little. The sweet spot is somewhere in the middle. And this is where mothers come in. The notable absence of female characters who can guide, nurture, and educate their children, lovers, and friends, points to a theme that she would continue to develop in all of her work. The need for strong women who can contain the excesses of male passions and teach those around them how to live balanced lives based on good judgment, civility, and love.